We will hear arguments first this morning in Escondido Mutual Water Company against La Jolla. Mr. Engstrand, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. It is an honor today for us to share our time with Solicitor Feit of the Commission, who will explain why Section 4E of the Federal Power Act does not give the Secretary's authority to veto licensing decisions of the Commission by imposing unreasonable conditions. I shall background the case and explain why the Indian bands have not been given the right by Congress to veto licensing decisions of the Commission, and I shall discuss why water rights are not similar to reservation lands. In Southern California, between Los Angeles and San Diego at Oceanside, the San Luis Rey River empties a 565 square mile watershed into the Pacific Ocean. In 1895, Western Movement pioneers constructed an intake in a deep canyon in the La Jolla Reservation and a canal over precipitous mountain terrain following the terrain to Lake Wolford near Escondido. In 1915, they added a power plant at Bear Valley, and in 1916, a power plant at the Rincon site. The canal and its works traverses three Indian reservations and occupies a tiny fraction, less than 1% of those reservation lands. The project in 1922, Henshaw Dam was constructed, and later the canal was enlarged in order to convey the water stored by the dam as well as the natural flow of the river above the intake and below the dam. These physical works were constructed by reason of legal arrangements made with the bands and the Secretary of Interior on their behalf, by contracts made in 1894, 1914, and 1922, a permit from the Secretary of Interior in 1908, and the Federal Power Commission license in 1924. Prior to 1969-1970, the bands or Interior made no objection to these works except by the filing of a claim before the Indian Claims Commission, which was opposed by the government. In 1971, Escondido sought relicensing, and at that time the bands sought to revoke our license, sought a non-power license for themselves. Interiors fully supported the band's position and even recommended that the United States recapture. In accordance with their authority under Section E, they sought to impose conditions which would have molded the project into a non-power contract not best adapted for development of the river as found by the Commission, but, in the words of the administrative law judge, to destroy the project. Interior candidly admits that it is not acting in the scope of its role in the best interests of the United States, but that it is totally blinded by its role as a guardian for the bands. The project and its works are small, on average 14,500 acre-feet of water and 4 million kilowatt-hours of power are produced. But in this semi-arid region, the water is important, and the power in these energy short times is consequential. The Commission in 1979, in two orders, granted a license jointly to Escondido and Vista. Petitions for review were heard by the Ninth Circuit, who reversed and remanded, and in October, you granted cert. There is no rational basis for the benefits of Project 176 to be taken away from the 110,000 citizens of Escondido and Vista. The bands bottom their contentions in notions about tribal sovereignty. But this is a false bottom, because we all recognize the plenary power of Congress over these tribal lands, and we know that Congress, in the public interest, has long determined that tribal bands, lands, are frequently necessary for use by non-tribal interests. The Congress has provided for railroads, tramways, canals, reservoirs, electric lines, water power projects to use tribal lands. We know that the broad plan and purpose of Congress in the Federal Power Act was to centralize and provide for the development of the water power resources of the country. We know that under the Act of March 3, 1891, the General Right-of-Way Statute, Congress provided for the use of tribal lands to encourage the western development. We know that under the Mission Indian Relief Act, MIRA, Congress provided that canal companies and citizens could use tribal lands for canal right-of-ways. The conflict here before your honors is, who did Congress designate as the final decision-maker about these tribal lands? I do not choose to forsake the many amici who have appeared on our behalf before your honors by focusing on tribal lands. The result would be the same if we were dealing with any other reservations. For if the Commission is not the final arbiter, the final decision maker, then we'll have to return to the same processes that were followed before the turn of the century, when special bills had to be introduced for the development of water power projects and use of tribal lands. The first hydro plant was built in 1890. We all know the congressional struggle that eventuated in the 1920 Power Act. In Tuscarora, this court noted that the Congress did not overlook, did not exclude, but specifically dealt with the tribal lands. The question, who should be the final arbiter? The Congress provided in Section 3.2 the tribal lands were to be covered by water power development. Section 4E gave to the Commission the authority to license project works on tribal lands. We know that the Senate amendment was rejected by Congress, which would have given Indians tribal consent necessary. The Congress also followed the traditional safeguards for Indian lands. In Section 4E, there's a requirement of a non-interference finding. In Section 10E, there's a requirement that reasonable compensation be paid for the use of tribal lands. In Section 10I, where the Commission is given authority to waive conditions for other projects, they cannot do that over tribal lands. And we know that under Section 17A, they provided the proceeds from the compensation for the use of tribal lands as assigned to the tribes involved. It is difficult to conceive how the drafters of congressional will could be more specific. As Judge Leventhal in the Montana Power Care said, Congress was aware of the conflict of the Secretary of Interior between the landowners of the tribal lands and the interests of licensees. The commission was meant to be the arbiter of the general interest. If the commission is not, decisions are not final, Congress's whole plan will be frustrated. It will be like an orchestra without strings, like a baseball team without a pitcher. Tribal consent would be destructive and not helpful. MIRA in 1891 provided for the use of tribal lands. It provided in 1891 that the consent of the tribal bands were necessary and the approval of the Secretary of Interior. But 3 months later, in the General Right-of-Way Statute of March 1891, the Congress provided that right-of-ways could be given with only the requirement from the Secretary of Interior. In 1898, the Secretary of Interior interpreted this to apply to tribal lands. The Ninth Circuit in 1914 approved this interpretation. Ever since 1898, under the Act of 1891 and under the 1920 Power Act, the administrative officials charged with the responsibility to enforce these acts have consistently interpreted the provisions as applying to tribal lands. And, Your Honors, I choose to reserve 5 minutes, if I may, for closing.
Mr. Feitz.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. As has been stated, this case involves the reach and scope of the proviso, the licensing proviso in Section 4E of the Federal Power Act. Of principal concern to the Commission today is the context involving the distribution of authority under that proviso between FERC and Interior. The proviso is set out at pages 2 and 3 of our main opening brief and requires that before issuing a license over reservation lands, the Commission must find that the license, and I quote, will not interfere or be inconsistent with the purpose for which such reservation was created or required, and should be subject to and contain such conditions as the Secretary of the Department, under whose supervision such reservation falls, shall be deemed necessary for the adequate protection and utilization of such reservation. The majority of the Court of Appeals below, purporting to rely on, we believe erroneously, on the plain language test, held that the Commission may not alter those conditions in any way. If the Commission is of the view that the terms are inappropriate or improper for the license it wishes, it may simply not issue the license. The Court further held that this conclusion did not grant the Secretary, quote, an unconditional veto power, since the reasonableness of the conditions was subject to judicial review under Section 313 of the Federal Power Act. It is our view that the position of Interior and the Court below seriously misapprehends the intent underlying the Section 4E proviso and undercuts in that regard the thrust and purpose of the Act, the licensing thrust. Surely at most times there is no problem. Both provisions work together. The Commission protects the physical homeland, and that's what the inconsistency and interference finding is all about. Security of the physical land, the population, number of homes in the area, the overall impact on the reservation qua a place for Indians to live. The Secretary, on the other hand, in our view, has a lesser, but lesser in scope. He must see to it that the project works be not so placed which would interfere with the health, safety, recreation, water flow, access roads, all of those things to protect the reservation and to see that the works are properly utilized. But beyond this, and there is an inherent tension between the two provisos, the interference inconsistency proviso and the protection proviso. The tension arises because, in a sense, they both work with another. That is, the Secretary supports the absolutist theory, saying that the conditioning power has no bearing on the interference inconsistency authority. The two functions are separate. That's not true as we read those two provisions. One may well be at war with the other, and seems to us the protection provision may try to take over the interference inconsistency provision. Two examples suffice, I think. Pigeon River case, which is an old administrative case in which Secretary Ickes wished that a dam not be built on an Indian reservation. And he submitted evidence in support of the view that the interference inconsistency determination should be exercised by the commission in a way against issuance in the license, but he said, in any event, I'm going to submit conditions which will not permit the dam to be built at all. This case, I think, also further illustrates where the Secretary seeks to impose upon the authority, the inconsistency interference authority of the commission. What has happened here is condition 4 submitted by the Secretary would require the commission to recognize the reserved water rights of the Indians. Well, the water rights issue is essentially not our business in terms of defining rights. That question is now in the Federal District Court, where it has been since 1969. We have an open-ended condition in a license which provides that the ultimate resolution of that issue by the district court will ultimately inform the license that we issue. So it's hard for us to perceive how this case involved a proper invocation of a power by the Secretary.
What effect would such a recognition have on the water rights litigation that's pending in the district court?
A recognition of the reserved interest rights?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anything in that sense of the word. I think that our statute precludes us from making such a finding. It would be ultra vires of our authority. To that extent, I think the district court opinion would be the one that's hold sway in the day. That is, that courts make that determination, and this commission, if it tried to do so, it seems to me, would be exercising absolute power that it just doesn't have. I'd like to turn to the legislative history, which I think supports our view. First of all, I want to point out there's an error at page 5 of our second supplemental brief in which we attribute to Senator Walsh a statement made by Congressman Walsh in an effort to distinguish Senator Walsh's apparent approval of the veto authority. That's an unfortunate error. I'm sorry for it. But in any event, it seems to us the Senator Walsh's statement is not all that persuasive. It was made in terms of a discussion with regard to the appropriateness of giving the Indians the authority to stop a project, and the Senator was responding to that. Also, Congressman Walsh, the statement we attribute to the Senate, did make that statement. He made it to Congressman Raker, who in fact was the House proponent of the administration bill, and made clear that he thought one vote could not terminate a project which two votes on the commission, which was then comprised of the three secretaries, War, Agriculture, Interior. There are statements in the Secretary's brief regarding the notion in the debate for the 20 Act, indicating that there was the view that a secretary could veto it. On the other hand, we think the evidence of legislative intent is spelled out more in our favor by other remarks which we've adduced in our brief. And it seems to us that this aspect, we think that as our brief points out, we have the better of the day. The one area of the legislative history which is not referred to at all in the Secretary's brief, it seems to us, is that the legislative history focuses again on no water control by the Commission, a focus on property rights, not broad interests, Indian concerns in the broadest sovereignty sense. And I think one illustration again here is good. The legislative history stems from the Rights of Way statutes. It's clear that the 1920 Act took those Rights of Way statutes as their base, developed on them, built on them, provided for them in the Act. At that time, under those rights of way statutes, the particular secretary had control over what we call now the interference inconsistency finding within those particular statutes. He also had the conditioning authority. But the conditioning authority, of course, was not meant to overcome the broad licensing authority that rights of way statute provided. On the contrary, it was to be exercised reasonably. And that's all we say here, that when Congress enacted the 1920 Act, what was a single power in each of the secretaries under the statutes they enforced became bifurcated. The commission was given the licensing power. The secretary was to retain the conditioning power, the impact of the project works on the reservation. That power to be exercised with reason. The secretary says, however, yes, we agree with the reasonableness approach to this case. However, that's a matter for the Court of Appeals to deal with, and all the commission has to do is simply include the secretary's condition, and if it's unreasonable, arbitrary, the Court of Appeals will remedy the situation. We don't think this really answers the question. In our view, it turns the review statutes on its head. Section 313 of the Power Act, A and B, deals with review. The court below realized the difficulty of using 313. Initially, on the opinion, it relied upon the APA saying the secretary's condition will be reviewed under the APA, the commission's under the Power Act. On rehearing, the court retreated, saying, well, recognizing that under this court's decision in the City of Tacoma case, that the review provisions of Section 313 are absolute, unconditional, and all issues must be resolved therein. Let me illustrate the problems of such a review provision. Under 313A, the commission, in its own judgment, may take a case back before a record is filed from a court of appeals. What do we do? Does Interior — we obviously can't do that. The commission may change its rule on rehearing. We have a statute which requires a rehearing requirement after the issuance of the order. The commission — the language is absolute in the statutory provision. Obviously, we can't do that. We have an obligation under the statute to establish a record evidence, substantial evidence test. The secretary's conditioning authority, if it's unalterable, imposes no requirement of a hearing or of a discussion of any sort. How do we determine that? We have the obligation to enforce our orders as well as our statute. How do we do that? The secretary says, well, a third party may raise the issue. Third party doesn't represent the public interest. The commission does. And the commission is in a bifurcated, unreal position, a distortion of the statutory terms. In sum, it is our position, and the position that is that the licensing authority of the commission is the central power to weigh and balance those interests which the Congress in its wisdom gave the commission to decide in determining whether to issue a license. The commission is obligated under the statutory terms to make a determination that the license is not inconsistent with, nor does it interfere with, the purpose for which the reservation was created or acquired. That's the essential power of the commission. The secretary, it seems to us, has the lesser power, which we normally and give great deference to when the problem rarely arises, to make such conditions which relate to the way the project works impact on the reservation. And it seems to us that that kind of decision-making, resting with the commission, at that time, the secretary having made a record the other way,
can
seek review.
You haven't said much about the statutory language. It's pretty strong. It's mandatory language. Shall be subject to and contain such conditions as the secretary shall deem necessary.
Yes, I turn to that right now, Your Honor. It seems to us, of course, as this court has said, that statutory language must really, even the use of shall may not be absolute. I think what
doesn't
we're saying
even have the word reasonable in it.
They didn't put the one word reasonable, but I think it was implicit in the situation in which the act was, which statute was enacted. It seems to us what happens is this: to the extent that the secretary performs in this area where there's no tension, and most of the situations are not, we will accept that condition. And I think that's what they were trying to say in the 20 Act. It seems to me if they were trying to say something else than that, then they would have said that. They wouldn't have given the commission the licensing authority. And in the way the commission must have the power, it seems to us, to assure that the conditioning authority is not used to defeat the interference inconsistency determination. It is there where the statute is not absolute. It is there where shall does not mean a veto. That is where shall simply means in the context of the exercise of clear authority. Otherwise, Mr. Justice, as I said, 313B is turned on its head.
May I ask this question? One of the briefs suggests that Section 15 of the Federal Power Act controls with respect to relicensing.
That issue, we believe, is not properly before the court in this case, since the commission specifically treated this license as an original license. And under the Chenery case and other cases, it seems to us the court cannot reach out to decide that case where the commission has not decided it. Thank you.
Mr. Shulgin.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I would like to begin my remarks by focusing on the reservation proviso of Section 4E of the Power Act. The language of that proviso clearly shows, in our view, that Congress sought to ensure that reservations would be protected from the adverse effects of power development. It is only after considering the import of the Section 4E proviso that the legal issues presented here can be properly addressed. It's the Secretary's position here that the statute, Section 4E, means exactly what it says. The statute provides that licenses may be issued for projects on reservations, but only if the Commission makes a finding that the license will not interfere or be inconsistent with the purposes for which the reservation was created, but also the licenses are specifically made to be subject to and to contain such conditions as the secretary of the department under whose supervision the reservation falls shall deem necessary for the adequate protection and utilization of the reservation.
Mr. Shulgin, do you still concede that if you are correct, that the conditions imposed by Interior have to be reasonable conditions?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And how is the... What is the process for review of the legality of those conditions? How does it work in light of Section 313? It's very unclear to me how you think the issue would be raised. Does it go to the commission in the first place, the power commission in the first place to decide, and how is the judicial review triggered?
The issue could not go to the commission to decide because that would negate the clear intent of Section 4E. Section 4E, which is the substantive grant of authority that is before the court in this case, clearly provides that it's the secretary who shall determine which conditions should be included within the license. So it makes no sense to say that the secretary can merely recommend conditions to the commission. That would read the second part of the reservation proviso out of the act. Now, it's true that the commission and the petitioners have argued that this would create some problems for judicial review. Well, there are several responses that I have to that. First of all, it seems to me that this would be a case of the tail wagging the dog. I mean, it's the substantive provision in 4E that gives the secretary the power. If there are any difficulties, and I don't concede that there are, in terms of reviewing the secretary's condition, it seems to me that the accommodation should be made on the judicial review end of the spectrum rather than on the rather than cutting back the secretary's authority.
As a practical matter, how do you see the review taking place, and how mechanically would it work?
The secretary's conditions must be included in the license that the commission issues. The commission's order issuing the license is subject to review in the Court of Appeals under Section 313 of
well,
the Power
Act. Well, suppose the commission thinks that they're unreasonable. How is the issue joined and put before the court?
Well, the commission can do one of two things at the licensing stage. The commission can either issue the license with the conditions and make clear in its order that it does not agree with the reasonableness of those conditions. The applicant at that point certainly could challenge, the applicant for the license certainly could challenge the those conditions in the Court of Appeals. And the secretary would be obligated to defend his conditions under the statutory standard that's laid out in 4E. In other words, the secretary must show that the conditions that he prescribes are reasonably related to the purpose of ensuring that the purposes of the reservation are adequately protected and that the reservation is adequately utilized.
But review in the Court of Appeals contemplates some sort of a record having been made somewhere, doesn't it? If the commission can't examine it all into the reasonableness of the secretary's conditions, where would the record be made on which the Court of Appeals would review reasonableness?
Well, the record, as in this case, would be the same record that is that was before the Court of Appeals. In other words, the applicant could present whatever evidence or information with respect to the adequacy of the conditions.
Present it to the commission?
Present it as part of his case.
To where?
Well, there are several ways in which this could be done. First of all, the secretary, as he did in this case, notified the parties of the proposed conditions that he intended to issue. He then asked for comments upon those conditions, and I believe one of the applicants did file certain comments. That is one way in which the parties would have an opportunity at the administrative level to make their views known. Second, in the course of presenting evidence to the commission on other aspects of the license, the parties would be, certainly with respect to the interference inconsistency finding, would present evidence that would be relevant to the secretary in his determination of whether the conditions that he proposes to include are proper. In fact, in this case, the secretary modified the initial conditions in order to take into account the evidence that had been brought out for
the
administrative
you're suggesting workers. That all the evidence would be presented to the commission, but that the commission can't make a finding on it. They can't weigh it, they can't consider it, they can't make a finding. So what is the Court of Appeals review? It's just confusing to see how it would work.
That it may be confusing, but the problem here is with not with 4E. If there is any problem, it may be with the judicial review provision of the statute.
Now, well, you do
it seems
agree
to me
there's
that,
a problem, don't you, on judicial review?
Well, the commission under 4E has no power to make any finding with respect to the secretary's conditions and has no power to alter or modify those conditions if you look at the language of 4E itself. It seems to me that it would be permissible or proper for the secretary's conditions to be reviewable before the Court of Appeals under the APA review standards as part of the same procedure in which the Court of Appeals is considering the commission's order issuing the license.
But APA review ordinarily goes to the district court.
It ordinarily does, but it does not in every case, Your Honor. The provisions of the APA specifically provide that it would go to the appropriate court to hear that matter. And here, since the whole case is going to the Court of Appeals to review the commission's order, it certainly seems appropriate that it would be the Court of Appeals that would pass upon, in the first instance, the reasonableness of the secretary's conditions.
Mr. Childers, it seems to me that there's nothing in 4E that prevents the commission from giving its opinion as to the reasonableness of the secretary's order. I thought you said that a while ago, that you could voice a disagreement.
Absolutely.
And I would suppose the parties before the administrative law judge could introduce any evidence going to the reasonableness of the secretary's conditions.
I agree.
And I would think 4E would be satisfied if the commission said, we have to incorporate these conditions. We've hassled around with the secretary. He won't give an inch. These are the conditions he insists on, so we put them in the license. But we think they are improvident, unreasonable, and that they will, in effect, destroy this project.
Well, that is precisely what Congress intended when it...
Well, you agree with that.
That's
you?
Correct.
So why do you say they aren't don't have no power to make a finding about or to as to reasonableness?
Well, I was just talking in terms of the technical language of the statute.
Well, so you can see that that based on the evidence in the record, as the commission reads it, it could say the secretary is out of his mind.
Certainly.
And then the Court of Appeals would be in the position to review it.
That's right. And this is precisely, if we look at the legislative history of the Federal Water Power Act prior to its enactment in 1920, this is exactly what Congress had in mind. If we look at the statements on pages 26 and 27
so
of the...
So where does that leave us in this case, Mr. Shulman?
Where does...
Well, the commission didn't include those conditions. Is that right?
That's right. The Court of Appeals remanded the case to the commission with directions that it follow the statute and include the secretary's conditions.
And if it does, there would still be left over the reasonableness of those conditions.
That's correct. That would
so
still
they,
be.
We shouldn't reach that issue now.
It's absolutely not before the court at this point, Your Honor.
But sooner or later, it likely will be.
That's correct. But the secretary's conditions have not been, they're not part of the commission's order because the commission refused to include them.
Well, Mr. Shulman, if no one else wants to initiate review of the commission's order, including now, as you tell us that they must, the secretary's conditions, may the commission, disagreeing with the reasonableness of the conditions, initiate that review?
No, Your Honor, because the whole process under 4E is a process in which an applicant goes to the commission requesting a license. Presumably, if the applicant is not sufficiently interested to pursue the matter, then that's the end of it. The commission has no affirmative authority to issue licenses where there are no applicants.
So it's disagreement with the conditions. It's feeling that they're unreasonable. It's not something that the commission can ask the Court of Appeals to review.
Not on its own initiative.
But the
it can certainly make its views known
the
to the
applicant. Can.
That's correct.
If the applicant wants to accept the conditions, of course, I suppose there won't be any case left.
That's correct.
But you wouldn't you would say the commission could appear in the Court of Appeals.
Oh, certainly.
And give its view.
Absolutely.
And here.
In this regard, I'd like to point out that, of course, Section 4E refers not only to reservations within the jurisdiction of the Secretary of the Interior, but also to reservations within the jurisdiction of the Secretary of Agriculture and the Secretary of Defense. In fact, if Your Honors would take a look at the map that's been provided by petitioners, it does not appear on the map, but several miles north of Oceanside is a very large marine base called Camp Pendleton. It seems to us that if there were any adverse effects of any project with respect to Camp Pendleton, the Secretary of Defense should be free.
Well, but Mr. Shulman, what about the word within in 4E? Camp Pendleton is not, I mean, the power project is not within Camp Pendleton, nor is it within three of the reservations here, as I understand the record.
That's correct. Well,
you rely on the plain language for part of your argument, but I don't suppose you do for those three reservations.
Well, it's not exactly that we don't rely on the plain language. The problem is that the plain language doesn't really make sense when you think of the broad definition of the term reservation in the statute. The term reservation includes tribal lands, but it also includes interests in lands owned by the United States. And a water right, as the Court of Appeals held in this case, at pages 25 to 26 of the appendix to the petition, a water right clearly is an interest in land. Now, certainly there's an ambiguity. It doesn't sound right to say that a license is issued within a water right.
Your position that the plain language is plain when it helps you and is ambiguous when it doesn't help you?
Not exactly, Your Honor.
Not exactly.
Well, I think that there is a real ambiguity here because of the broad definition of the term reservations in the definitional section of the Act. Now, and if you take that into consideration with Section 23B, which states that the Commission shall issue licenses where a project will have an effect on a reservation, that suggests to us that, in fact, given the protective nature of the definition of reservations, the protective nature of Section 4E itself, that, in fact, the Secretary of Defense would be entitled to impose conditions on a license if an upstream project were threatening to impair the utilization of that military base.
Mr. Shuler, is there an issue before us as to the power of the tribes to veto?
Well, the issue about whether Section 8 of the Mission Indian Relief Act has been impliedly repealed by the Federal Power Act is the third issue in the case, and it's our position, as we stated in our brief, that it has not been repealed by the Federal Power Act.
And if it hasn't been, what is the authority of the tribe?
If it has not been, then any water conveyance facility that will be going across a reservation land must be approved by the bands before that facility can be operated.
Well, if you're right in that regard, does that render the rest of the case almost beside the point?
It might, as a practical matter, Your Honor.
What could they veto in this case?
Well, they could state that they do not agree to the canal going across their reservations.
You mean to the extent it's going to be changed? There's already a canal across their reservations, isn't it?
That's correct, but to the extent that it's going to continue in operation, and also to the extent that it may be changed in the future.
So this is you treat this as a new licensing?
That's correct. We agree with the Commission that this case should be treated as an original licensing.
So that if the tribes have a veto, the case is really over.
That's correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Shuler, I'm a little bothered by the posture of the case that Justice White just adverted to. It seems to me that if one is seeking an original license that for a project that's never been built before, it's one thing to say that the Indian reservation, federal reservations generally should have a veto power and you shouldn't put it in where they don't want it and that sort of thing, if it's basically their jurisdiction. But if substantial outlays have already been made for pipes and canals and that sort of thing, then is the inquiry exactly the same at the relicensing stage?
Well, we believe that it is, because every applicant at the relicensing stage is at an equal level. That Congress specifically provided in the Federal Power Act that there would be a 50-year term to the license. And I believe the band's brief in its introduction to the summary of argument sets out the statutory scheme. In fact, the Commission in this case concluded that the net investment and severance that would have to be paid to the licensee, the original licensee in this case, was zero.
It all been returned.
That's correct. Thank you.
Mr. Fillinger.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'd like to begin by addressing a few of the issues that were raised previously. First of all, with regard to the judicial review question, I think I agree with Justice White's analysis of that. Let me just add that I see no difference between the Court of Appeals review of the Secretary's conditions as opposed to the Commission's own conditions. The record is compiled before the Federal Power Commission, or the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and an applicant can, based on that record, can contest either the commission's conditions based on their lack of reasonableness or the secretary's conditions based on their lack of reasonableness. So I don't see that it presents any problems or any difficulties. With regard to relicensing, Justice Rehnquist, I would point out that Section 15, which is the relicensing provision, specifically says that the commission is authorized to issue a new license to
the... Is that in one of the briefs, that the section you're quoting from?
Is the section...
What you're just reading, is it in one of the briefs, or one could find it?
I think I have a footnote in my brief on that, Your Honor. I can't put my finger on it.
Go ahead.
What section are you quoting from?
I'm quoting Section 15A. It's 16 U.S.C. Section 808A. I have it. Okay.
Of what act?
It's in the, it's in the Petitioner's Appendix of Federal
Power. Of what act are you?
Of the Federal Power Act. It's in the Petitioner's Appendix at page 386.
Right.
Thank you. And this is the relicensing provision. Now, I don't understand why there's a controversy about whether this is an original licensing or a relicensing, because the relicensing provision specifically says that the Commission can issue either a new license or an original license under the then-existing laws and regulations. And obviously, the reservation proviso is an existing law. So as the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit held in the La Couture case, which is cited in the briefs, the whole concept of relicensing was that it would be a new proceeding and it would take place under the terms of existing laws. And this court... This court's only decision dealing with this relicensing question was United States against Appalachian Electric Power Company in 311 U.S. 377, where the court specifically referred to the relicensing provisions and upheld their constitutionality against the claim that they would constitute an unlawful taking of land without providing just compensation. Justice O'Connor, the Secretary's conditions would not be an adjudication of water rights by the back door. The whole point of the Secretary's conditions is to set forth that which would be necessary to provide for the adequate protection and utilization of the reservation. Those conditions can be considered as if one assumed that there were no water rights of the reservations. The Secretary is simply saying this is what's necessary to protect those reservations and to ensure their adequate utilization.
And it would have no effect on the pending water rights litigation?
That's right. Unless the petitioners, it would not affect the existing water rights dispute unless the petitioners were not able to utilize their water right, in which case the dispute would not be resolved but would become moot, essentially. Now, the petitioners are seeking here to enter three Indian reservations to gain use and control of Indian lands without obtaining the Indians' consent for the purpose of diverting water away from six reservations. The reason that they're invoking the Federal Power Act, despite the fact that the hydroelectric aspects of this project are incidental and de minimis, is that without a license from the Commission, they would be required to bargain with the bands and the Secretary of the Interior for the use of reservation lands. So they're attempting to use the Power Act to circumvent or avoid the requirements of other laws. This is doubly ironic because, in the first place, the power aspects of the projects are, as I indicated, so small and incidental. And secondly, because the Power Act so explicitly ensures that the interests of Indians as well as other federal reservations will not be sacrificed to the development of hydroelectric power. There are two aspects of this case that I want to stress. The clearly expressed
you're,
will...
You're not challenging, Mr. Pelzer, the jurisdiction of the Federal Power Commission?
No, we did
because
not...
Because of the thin reed that the power thing is hinged?
We did not cross-petition on that ground. That's correct. But I think that issue is still relevant when addressing the question of which act is controlling in these particular and unique circumstances, the more general statute of the Federal Power Act, which only tangentially applies to this project, if at all, assuming it applies at all, or the much more specific provision of Section 8 of the Mission Indian Relief Act, which is what this case is all about.
Well, I don't think there's any halfway house. It seems to me if you concede that it's before the Federal Power Commission, the Federal Power Act certainly applies. That doesn't say it overrides the Mission Indian Act.
I agree with that. I agree. But the question of whether it overrides the Mission Indian Relief Act may turn in part of whether this case is really a power project, in which case it would come squarely within the Federal Power Act, or whether it's really a water diversion project, and that's its principal effect.
Well, do you say then that if it were 60% power and 40% water diversion, which I take it this is not, bands would have a weaker case?
If, to put that issue in context, our first position is that the provision of the Mission Indian Relief Act must be given effect because the reservation proviso specifically protects against interference the purposes of Indian reservations. The Mission Indian Relief Act defines the purposes of Indian reservations and therefore, pursuant to 4E, must be given effect. But if the court disagrees with that, and if the court concludes that somehow the Indian consent requirement may, under some circumstances, be inconsistent with the Federal Power Act, then one looks to the particular project involved. And since this case is first and foremost and primarily a water diversion project, the Mission Indian Relief Act should control here, even if it wouldn't control if this were a real, true-to-life, honest-to-goodness power project. That's our position. This is not, let me stress, a case in which the Indians must ask the court to presume that the federal government intended to deal fairly with the Indians or to implement an assumed solicitous attitude. Rather, both the Federal Power Act and the Mission Indian Relief Act manifest on their faces and in their histories the clear and specific intent to preserve the integrity of Indian reservations and fully to protect Indian property rights and Indian sovereignty.
What business does the does the commission have, or what authority does it have over a straight water diversion project? None, does it?
That's correct. But this project has two minimally
I understand.
Mid-sized power plants.
But it wasn't one of the power plants built, and isn't it run by water taken out of a reservoir by a canal?
Both of them are, yes. One of them is directly from a canal, and one of them is through a reservoir.
And the canal takes water for metropolitan use?
No. This is
just a straight power?
Well, oh, I'm sorry, for municipal use, yes.
Yes. Down to Escondido? And
yes, and to Vista.
Uh-huh. And and do you say that that project is at risk now, too, that just the metropolitan water use?
The canal that crosses the reservations. Yes, we say that the right-of-way was granted, Justice White, in 1924 for 50 years. Mm-hmm. That right-of-way expired in 1924. They've had it for 60 years. They got all that they bargained for. They got more than they bargained for. Their investment is fully paid off. And now it's a new proceeding.
And this is wholly aside from whether it's a power project or not.
Yes, although, as I explained to Justice Rehnquist, I think that the incidental nature of the power aspect can come into play if the court concludes that under certain circumstances, if this were a real, true, honest-to-goodness power project, Indian consent would be overridden by the Act. The fact that this is not a real power project means that effect can and must and should be given to the very specific statute. After all, it was the first and only time that Congress specifically addressed the issue of what should happen with regard to water conveyance projects across the lands of the Mission Indian reservations. It enacted Section 8, and Section 8 requires the consent of both the Indian tribes and the Secretary of the Interior. And that intent is what is controlling in this case.
Well, was the original 50-year license for the water project at that time tied up with the power project, too, or wasn't it?
Yes. The conveyance system is the same. The water is conveyed and it both
this
generates.
This was long before the Federal Power Act.
Yes, that's right.
And so where did from whom did the easement or right-of-way run?
Well, there are a combination of those sources. Originally, there was the Secretary of the Interior granted a permit in 1908. There was one contract with an Indian band that was approved pursuant to Section 8.
For both the power and the water?
No, at that time there was no power.
Just water?
Just water. Let me also point out that that both the Escondido and Vista areas, there's no issue in this case that those areas are going to be deprived of their only supply of water. Both of them have alternate sources of water from the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California that bring in the water from the Colorado River and Northern California.
They might also strike a deal with the tribe.
That's
right. They
just
might have to pay a little more money.
That's absolutely right. And the issue here is that the San Luis Rey River supply is somewhat cheaper than the alternate supply that's imported through the Metropolitan Water District. But there's no evidence in this record to indicate that the welfare or the economies of these areas would be adversely affected in the slightest bit if they had to obtain all of their water from the alternate source where they're now obtaining most of their water.
How many reservations, through how many reservations does the canal go?
Three. And the total, and the project diverts waters away from six reservations. Six Indian reservations.
And what's the total mileage of the canal as it runs through the reservations, you know?
Those figures I don't have them immediately available.
Might have them on the tip of your tongue.
They're in the commission's opinion, I'm sure. Now, so far as the applicability of the Mission Indian Relief Act is concerned, the petitioner's primary contention is that Section 8 can and should be ignored because it was effectively repealed by the Federal Power Act, because they claim that Section 8 is inconsistent with the Federal Power Act. But the fatal flaw in this argument is that it entirely overlooks the reservation proviso itself, which expressly prohibits any interference with the purposes for which the reservations were established. This proviso, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, would be totally meaningless if Congress intended to sanction the abrogation of the rights and powers guaranteed to Indian tribes by pre-existing treaties and statutes. Now, the other principle...
Well, of course, even if you were wrong on that, if the Secretary happens to be right on his side of the case, he will have the authority to put all the conditions in he wants to.
That's correct. There's dual protection and dual safeguards. The petitioner's other argument on the Mission Indian Relief Act is that Section 8 and the Federal Power Act should be viewed as alternate mechanisms for obtaining canal rights of way across Mission reservations. That makes no sense whatsoever. The one point on which all parties in this case are agreed is that the use of Indian lands for a power project, and this is assumedly a power project, requires a commission license. Now, it may also require Indian consent, and that's the issue, but it certainly requires a commission license. So since a commission license would be required and necessary in any event, obtaining the consent of the Indians and the Secretary of the Interior under Section 8 is not a true alternative. It would be entirely superfluous and unnecessary because it would never be utilized if the commission's license had to be obtained in any event. By contrast, requiring, as both the bands and the secretary contend, requiring both a commission license as well as compliance with Section 8 of the Mission Indian Relief Act gives effect to both statutes while preserving their overall sense and purpose and does not subordinate one to the other. On the definition of reservations, I agree with Mr. Scholder. The ambiguity that's created here is that water rights are expressly included, and there's no doubt about that, within the Act's definition of reservations. That much is clear and unambiguous. The ambiguity arises because the reservation proviso applies to licenses within a reservation, and the question is, how can a license be within a water right? That doesn't really make sense. And so that is a real true-to-life ambiguity. And our contention is that that ambiguity has to be resolved in favor of the downstream reservations for several reasons. First and foremost is that that interpretation carries out and furthers the evident protective purpose toward reservations in the Federal Power Act, both in the reservation proviso itself as well as in the broad definition of reservation in the Act. And secondly, as Mr. Scholder pointed out, because of the provision in Section 23B that indicates that the word effect, that uses the word effect,
in a synonymous context with the word within in Section 4E, and thirdly, because Section 10E of the Act expressly uses the term tribal lands embraced within Indian reservations in defining when annual charges are to be fixed by the Commission. So when Congress wanted to limit the term Indian reservations to lands that are physically within reservation boundaries, it knew very well how to do that, and it did it in Section 10E. Thank you.
Do you have anything further?
Your Honor, if I may, on this question of water rights, the reason the land needs to be protected is because there are physical imposition on the land. The reason water rights need not be protected is because the courts protect the water rights. And the Congress said in Section 27 that nothing in the Federal Power Act would interfere with the rights of the water rights given by the states for the control and use of water. This complex arrangement that Mr. Scholder talked about, of course, Congress didn't lay that out. Where would the fact finder be that you were going to weigh the substantial evidence rule against if you don't read reasonable in front of the word shall? And I think that's what Justice McKinnon said in the Couturier. He said that you must probably, he was saving that until later, it wasn't ripe for decision, but that Congress must have meant substantially or reasonable.
Well, I take it the United States agrees the Secretary's conditions must be reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor, and
the Commission may say what it thinks about his conditions. They just have to put him in.
Yes, I don't see how that can work, like Justice O'Connor suggested. I think that one thing that is clear that overrides all this is that the Congress was explicit in the role the Commission should play in water power development. The Congress was explicit that tribal lands were to be available for water power projects. The Congress was explicit that the decision maker should be the Commission, the independent body. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...